part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com.
Well, welcome to the Part-Time Fanboy podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I feel like it's been a little bit in the making, but I'm glad to finally be talking to you.
No, I mean, we kind of set this up a little back and forth, a couple of months ago, but I mean, it's great to have you on. I should say your name is Richard Hamilton, correct?
That's right. Well, if you don't mind, it's Richard Ashley Hamilton.
I was wondering, Richard Ashley Hamilton. Got it. If I should use the middle name.
It's to disambiguate me for some other authors out there that are named just Richard Hamilton.
Got it.
It makes my mom happy when people say my full name. So that's the other part of it, I guess.
Absolutely. No, that's great. Well, my name is Christian Horn. You are Richard Ashley Hamilton. This is the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. And again, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we are here to talk about, you have two books out, or one is coming out, right?
That's right. That's right.
That's called Tective, correct?
That's correct. That comes out December 10th in bookstores, which I think means December 11th in comic shops. And that's through Maverick, which is the kind of YA imprint of Mad Cave Studios. And then I have another series that's out that's called Scoop, which is also through Maverick. And two volumes are out now. Volume two just came out last month, October. Uh-huh. Two more volumes are on the way for next year.
Which one would you like to talk about first? Because, I mean, we've got time. They're both great books. I was given the privilege of, checking out Tective, like an early sort of like a preview of that, and I really enjoyed it. And I also read the first volume of Scoop and really enjoyed that as well. There's a couple of things I can discern by reading your books. First of all, you seem to either be like a big kind of like Nancy Drew or Hardy Boys fan. There's some Miyazaki in there, and there's a Hall & Oates vibe, like running through both books a little bit. Right?
Totally guilty as charged on Hall & Oates. They're my favorite, and I find a way to include them in pretty much everything I write.
That's
even
great.
like period piece things where they have no business being there, but I can't help them. I can't help it. They're the best. Definitely on the kind of teen sleuth vibe. I read a lot of Hardy Boys as a kid, but my favorite show of all time is Veronica Mars. That is a huge, huge part of like the genetic structure of Scoop and also of Tective. The Miyazaki thing, thank you for saying that. I honestly think that was I worked at DreamWorks Animation for about a decade.
Oh, nice.
And I was fortunate enough to work on the How to Train Your Dragon films and assist the writer director Dean Deblois, and I was also the script coordinator. And so much of what I know about world building and storytelling and really kind of putting the primacy on emotion over plot, I really owe all of that to Dean. I think maybe that's what you're picking up on there. And when we not to sort of jump ahead, but Scoop is set in the real world. It's set in my hometown of Miami, but sort of a heightened one because there's a lot of sci-fi stuff in there that we can get into. But Tective is set in a very far future version of my current home, Los Angeles. We say it's a post-apocalyptic version.
Uh-huh.
And so that required a tremendous amount of world building. And so I definitely tried to apply all the lessons that Dean taught me on How to Train Your Dragon and figure out like what, there are so many post-apocalyptic worlds in comics and novels and film and TV and, you know, every kind of literature and entertainment. So how can we make ours very specific and unique to the story? And, you know, how can it be not just like a dangerous and interesting world for our main character Bingo to explore, but how can it also be sort of a reflection of her and what she's going through, what her journey is? So that was kind of the impetus behind the world building. And then really the main secret weapon and all that is our artist, Marco Matrone, who just took all these ideas and ran with it. And you know, I don't know how you feel about it reading it, but for me, when the pages would come in, it was this world that was, you know, both savage and also very beautiful at the same time. And I'm so blown away by what he did on our book.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, well, let's start off with Tective since we're already talking about that. And you mentioned How to Train Your Dragon. Like, I love those movies. Like, my daughter, my family, we went to go see those in the theater, and they like quickly became our favorite. So if that is the vibe that is sneaking through, then it's a good vibe for sure. it's like definitely one of the better sort of like animated franchises that has come out of like whatever Hollywood in the past 10, 15, 20 years or whatever. But
I completely agree. I'm a little biased, but yes, it's the best.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I very much enjoy it. We actually went to Universal City Walk, like the horror thing that they do. Yes. And of course, the one thing that I bought was like a toothless, like little keychain thing, because I love the statue. And I didn't buy any horror stuff. I bought that. Like, I don't know if that makes me lame or cool. I don't know. But either way, that shows you how much I love how to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it definitely cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's start off with the basic concept of Tective, because I didn't know what to expect when I went into this book. And when I started reading it, I love post-apocalyptic stuff. Like, I'm a child of the 80s. I grew up with nuclear warfare hanging over my head at any moment. Like, you know, germ warfare, all that stuff. The pandemic was a very singularly anxious moment, like, for everyone. But for me, I'm like, oh my God, are we all going to die? Like, what is happening? I really, really, when I got into this, like, very much enjoyed it. It was very much in my wheelhouse. And I'm a very big Miyazaki fan too. Like, just love his stuff. And we already, you know, mentioned how much I love How to Train Your Dragon. So, can you tell people a bit about what Tective is about? Because I found it to be like really like interesting and unique in the way that it approaches like the post-apocalyptic kind of like genre.
Well, thank you, first of all. And I'm a child of the 80s too. So I also grew up under those looming specters of, you know, nuclear holocaust and all kind of World War III and all that. Yeah. And, you know, when I was growing up in Miami, I lived through Hurricane Andrew. And really, that's obviously not the same as like an apocalypse, but, you know,
close enough.
14 when it happened, and it was really a radical, not in a good way, in a bad way, to just see like your hometown completely transformed and all these things that you took for granted, like electricity and telephones and you know, going to a grocery store and ice and refrigeration for food was all taken away, you know, gas station. And it was brutal going through it, although we had it better than so many other people who lost their homes. We didn't lose ours, but it was a real experience, you know? And so I guess I've always sort of had that in the back of my mind. And the way I would relate it to Tective is it's set in this far future version of LA. A giant cataclysm has happened. We sort of hint at what it is. We will explore it in future volumes, but there is kind of a rationale and an answer, but there's this big event, and this now takes place, you know, thousands of years after that. And Los Angeles has reverted to kind of its original state, which was like a very agrarian sort of farming community. Mm. And, you know, like on paper, it looks very much like utopia, and they really pride themselves on being, you know, post-racism, post-misogyny, post-crime, post-everything. There hasn't been a crime in thousands of years, and therefore there hasn't been any need for like any police or anything. And so that's the world, but the story really revolves around our main character. Her name is Bingo Finder. Her last name is Finder because that's her job. She's a scavenger. So just kind of like in the old days of, colonies and stuff, somebody, their last name would be Cutler because they made cutlery or, Smith, whatever. So Bingo Finder is a scavenger, and she just goes through all these ruins of Los Angeles that are now, really reclaimed by nature, kind of eerily beautiful the way Marco draws them, and, finds goods for her community to barter for things she needs to live. And her favorite thing to find is books. And, they're pretty rare to find them because the paper would have, been destroyed in all this time. But every now and then she'll hit her treasure trove. And so she finds with basically like a bomb shelter or a panic room, and it's filled with this amazing book collection. And her favorite books of all are detective stories. But the ones that she has, the covers are all worn off of them, and some of the letters are missing from the tattered pages. So it just reads detective instead of detective. So that's kind of like her life. And she has a best friend, but then her best friend disappears under mysterious circumstances. And Bingo, wants to know what happened to her friend, and is her friend okay, and who's going to help her friend? And because the society hasn't dealt with the crime in thousands of years, they're completely useless. They don't know what to do at all. And Bingo thinks back to her books, and she's like, well, you know what? This is the first crime in thousands of years, and now I need to be like those guys in the books. I need to wear a trench coat and a hat and walk around the city of LA and to help someone. I'm going to become a detective. And so that really sort of launches her off on her path. And so detective, like you, I'm a huge post-apocalyptic and sort of dystopian fiction fan. And one of my other all-time favorite genres is noir, film noir, noir fiction, crime. Sure. So detective is very much a fusion of like a noir detective story in a post-apocalyptic world. And in true noir fashion, when Bingo starts looking for her friends, she starts to uncover secrets about her city and her world. And maybe it isn't quite the utopia everyone purports it to be. Maybe it isn't quite so post-crime or post-racism or post anything else. And she starts to also uncover new things about herself and starts to question herself too. And what's her place in this world? And, has she sort of been looking the other way while all these things have been happening in secret? That's kind of the plot, but, it's got kind of like that questioning, morally gray vibe of noir, but we also have giant talking coyotes. We have mutants. We have, it's not a car chase cause there's no cars. Technology is outlawed in the future, but we have a rickshaw chase. We do like a lot of fun stuff in our setting and really try and like pay off all the world building that we put into it.
Yeah. It was interesting to me, how much, I mean, obviously there's a noir sort of like detective, thing flowing through it because that's what the main character kind of idolizes. But it's interesting to me that the visual aspect of the book, when I was reading it, again, I keep going back to Miyazaki because of the talking, coyotes and stuff like that, and the animals and the brightness of the colors and things like that. Was that something that you were looking to make when you were thinking about creating this book? Like not noir, but something opposite, more like bright and colorful?
Very much so.
Got it.
As I like to think I'm generally a positive and optimistic person. And as much as I love noir, they're not really known for their happy endings.
Sure.
And I knew, I knew this book was aimed at a younger audience. And I always like to, kind of give our younger readers some sense of hope because they give me that just by kind of the way they live their lives in this crazy world of ours in the present, forget about the post-apocalyptic version. And so we really wanted to kind of counterbalance, some of the moodier moments and some of the kind of more introspective ones. with things that were just, you know, like really fun and really cool, and things that you can only do in comics, and things that, you know, you can only do in sort of like this whacked out post-apocalyptic world of ours. So that was kind of the hope, was, you know, to sort of balance out the light and the dark, and, you know, to still have Bingo question herself and maybe have our readers start to kind of question how do they live their lives? What's their relationship to their community? Is there anything that they could be doing to make it better? Or, you know, is there anyone that they can help out? Or, you know, how can they live their lives in a good way? So, you know, but we didn't want that to be like super heavy or didactic or like, you know, you're being lectured to. So, yeah, we've got, you know, talking animals and robots and all that. And, you know, we also set the story, we don't mention a specific year, but it's so far in the future that basically every post-apocalyptic thing that you can imagine has already happened and is somehow included in the world. So that gave us a lot of toys to play with too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting to me how well you sort of balance the kind of light and dark in this book, because I mean, when I first started reading it, I was like, okay, you know, I've had several Mad Cave creators on the podcast because they're very generous, you know, with their publicists, and they pass people on to me. And I know that the Maverick imprint is more kind of like YA. And in my brain, you know, for some reason that skews younger than maybe I think it does. Like, I don't know, maybe because I don't know why, but I was like reading it and I was like, oh, there's some skeletons in here. They come across human remains. And then one of these things that kind of like sets things in motion, you know, I don't want to spoil things, but it's like a character does something. I don't know how to explain it without ruining it, but do you see where I'm going? Where it's like, like self-harm or something like that. And it's like, oh wow. Like, how hard was it for you to sort of walk that line? Because I don't think you ever like fully ever cross it, but there were times where I was like, in my brain, I was like, oh, this is Maverick, but I'm seeing this. And again, like I said, you never cross the line, but I was like so curious about like, where is that when you're creating a book for YA audiences?
Well, that is an excellent question. And that is the question that, you know, I think we all like as a team on these books sort of ask at the beginning.
Sure.
I guess I personally don't worry about that line so much, because I don't even like acknowledge it in a weird way. Like, so like we were saying earlier, I'm a child of the 80s, right?
Yeah.
So I grew up with all the wonderful Amblin movies, you know, Goonies and E.T.
Yeah.
Even, I mean, Back to the Future, and I know Ghostbusters isn't Amblin, but I roll that all up in there.
Sure.
And I loved it because the kids were, especially like in the case of Goonies, they're typically the smartest people in the room or underground or wherever. Yeah. And they faced real danger and real peril. And as a kid watching it, I don't think I could have articulated it this way then, but I really liked that I wasn't being talked down to, and that the kids were in real danger, and it made me imagine what would I do if I were in that situation. And I love that. And I feel like since then, probably for the best possible reasons, a lot of the storytelling, especially in the United States, has changed and has been kind of sanitized and made things less dangerous for kids.
Mm.
And again, I think that was like all with the best of intentions, but it sort of took away something critical, which is like giving kids and the audience a chance to sort of imagine these scenarios and what they would do with them in kind of the, from the safer move of fiction, right?
Yeah.
And another, sorry to name drop, but when I worked at DreamWorks, I also worked on Trollhunters with Guillermo del Toro.
Nice.
It's pretty awesome. And he's, you know, a really, you know, I mean, he's like us. He's a part-time fanboy, full-time fanboy. But he's, you know, a real treasure trove of, you know, he thinks a lot about storytelling. And he always said there's this one thing that was super important that went away that kids really needed and it no longer exists, and that's fairy tales. Mm. And, you know, how like Hansel and Gretel or Snow White or whatever would like, you know, through those stories, kids would learn about like death, you know, and loss and danger. And they were, you know, entertaining, but they're also sort of like cautionary tales. And it would give kids kind of like a safe, healthy way to process their feelings about all that stuff. And when you take away fairy tales and that kind of storytelling, you also take away a young person's ability to do that kind of processing, right? And so they are confronted with it in their real life. They might not be as well equipped to handle it. So, sorry, end of rant. I'll get off my soapbox now. But
No.
To answer your question, I think because of my background at DreamWorks, I try and write things that everyone can enjoy, whether they're really young or you know, a teenager or even a parent. Because, like, you know, How to Train Your Dragon movies, I think one of the reasons they were so successful is, like, you know, the kids liked all the young characters, but as a parent, you know, maybe you sort of identify with Stoic, the dad, you know, or Valka, the mom, or Gobber, you know, like, kind of the adult characters kind of were treated real too, and you know, everyone in the audience could find a different way into the story. So I always try and do that with everything I do. And you know, as far as this being like a YA book versus, you know, sort of a mainline Mad Cave book, I think those distinctions are largely arbitrary, and they're mostly in the US, and in other countries in Europe, they don't really distinguish so much between them.
Got it.
But I think because our protagonist is a young girl, she's, you know, about 16, 17, that starts to put it in the YA camp. And I'm fine with that. Like, I love YA. I love writing, you know, specifically for that audience. But I'm always quick to tell people, like, you know, if you're an adult, I think you would still enjoy this book. And if you're younger, teenager, you'd probably still enjoy this book. And part of that comes from kind of the 80s Amblin thing. And part of that also comes from when I was growing up, like, you know, if I was reading an X-Men book or Spider-Man or Superman or whatever, it was the same version that like a 30-year-old or 40-year-old would have been reading, right? Like, we'd all get it on the spinner rack.
Yeah.
And back then, it wasn't like, there wasn't like Superman Adventures and then Superman. There wasn't like a little kid version of the book.
Yeah.
And so it was like one book that was written to kind of appeal to everyone. And you know, as near as I could tell, it did. So that's the same thing I guess I'm trying to do with my comics.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I really liked about Detective in particular was this kind of like journey that the main character goes through, because it's like, it's really fun to see somebody sort of like, oh, I want to be a detective, right? Like, I want to, you know, talk cool and wear the hat and the coat and kind of cosplay. And then they get into like the things that detectives do, and things get like really complicated, and it becomes like a journey of like, wait a minute, like, this is not how I pictured things at all. And I think it's a really good commentary on like getting, crossing over into maturity and adulthood, which I very much liked about this story.
Well, thank you. I mean, you've read it, so you know it starts to get pretty real.
Yeah.
Bingo. And it also comes at sort of several great personal costs. So I thought that was important to do too, because like, for everything I just said about YA and like, I don't really distinguish, I'm not going to talk out of the other side of my mouth and say that I'm also aware that this book is aimed at young people. And so like, I never want to be cavalier about violence. I always try and show like the consequences of violence if we have to have it in the books. And I think those, you know, like in real life, if you're exposed to violence or something really dangerous, it's not like you just shake it off the next day and you go back to business as usual. Like, you are affected from that, often permanently, but at the very least for like, you know, months, maybe years after, right? And I want to be able to kind of show that and kind of model like a little bit of reality, even though we're in this very fantastical, far future world. So, you know, it was like, there's always kind of like the fun of, you know, it's like if you're watching a movie, there's kind of like the suit up sequence where like somebody, you know, superhero puts on their costume for the first time or whatever. And that's really fun. And we do that with Bingo when she like, because she's a scavenger, she's also a little bit of a hoarder. And so she's able to find an old fedora and put it on, and an old trench coat and put it on, and kind of approximate the silhouette of the detective. And she even like tries to do like sort of the moody PI narration and sort of messes up on her first few attempts, but then starts to get it right. So we definitely love to have fun with all those tropes and play with them. But I also felt like it was kind of incumbent upon us to show the flip side of that and show like, well, you know, being a detective isn't all jokes. There's real danger to it and there's stakes. So I think that's where that was coming from.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that I really kind of like appreciated very much so about this story is that the world, like you said, is kind of established as this kind of bright, you know, post whatever, post everything, post violence, post. And then as you sort of like get into it, it gets darker and darker and she kind of gets dragged along with it. And I just thought that that you did that in a very cool and interesting way, because I mean, there's a lot of times where you see like post-apocalyptic fiction and it, you know, it's kind of flat. There's not like a big, huge arc, but there's like a really good sort of, I guess that's the word for it, arc that your character takes. And I thought you did it was very well done.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, I wish I could take all the credit for that, but I can't, you know, Marco, like his, you know, acting and the way that he rendered the world.
Yeah, it's great.
The book wouldn't exist without him, or certainly not the way it is now. And I mean, that's kind of the cool thing about noir and even like film noir. So much of that was set in Los Angeles because, you know, even back then it was kind of this glitzy, glamorous place, but you know, everyone knows by now that LA sort of has like a dark, seedy underbelly as well, right?
Yeah.
In that sense, that really hasn't changed in the far future either. But you know, also like our editors, Mike Martz and especially Christina Harrington, were so helpful in guiding all that, because it's really easy to get lost in the woods on these things. If it's a noir story, it can get too dark or too abstract. If it's world building, it could just get to be too much about like plot and cool concepts and not really about like character emotion. So they really kept me honest throughout the whole thing. And every note they gave me, I used, because it just made the story and the characters better.
That's great. I mean, one of the things I commented on earlier about this book was the world building, sort of like the post-apocalyptic future that you set it in. Did you write out like a Bible? Did you come up with like how deep into it did you get? Because I mean, it seems very fully thought out. I thought everything like really worked and there was never a moment where I ever felt like, yeah, that doesn't work, or like that doesn't seem to like, and you were very good at sort of not only establishing the world, but like having it feel like there were no rules broken, like within the story that you set. Am I making any sense there?
You're making complete sense to me. And I so appreciate that, because that is a huge part of world building for me, is like, it has to have an internal validity.
Yeah.
Like, you can make the most whacked out place in the world you want, but once you've established that it has a certain logic, you have to stick with that. Because the second you break it, you lose your audience. Because then it's like, well, then anything can happen. And if anything's possible, then who cares? You know? Yeah. So that was very much planned out. I don't know that it was like a Bible per se, because like in animation, we would do, you know, Bibles for like every franchise or every show we were working on. And, you know, pretty much by like the fourth episode of a show, you've already so deviated so completely from whatever was in the Bible anyway, that it doesn't matter, but it's a place to start. And so I knew broad strokes what the world was going to be. I knew what the cataclysm was that precipitated, you know, all this damage and the world that we now find, you know, after 1,000 years of healing from it. But I didn't want to get too in the nitty gritty, like in Bible form, because then I think it starts to take the fun out of like the discovery part of the writing as you're writing the actual book. And also, like, you know, when, you know, pages would come in from Marco, there would be like a certain character or location that was almost meant to be a little bit of a throwaway, although we never try to have any throwaway anything in Detective.
Sure.
But I would just see this design and be like, oh my God, this character's so cool. We got to use him more. And so the story kind of starts to deviate from the plans, you know, just like I was saying. So it's always trying to find that balance of like having the big picture, but also allowing enough wilderness in there for you to kind of like blaze new trails as you're writing, and you feel the characters taking you in the direction that they want to go in.
Yeah.
And then the other part of it was like, because this is equal parts dystopian fiction and noir, I wanted to like touch on all those sort of tropes of like a detective story, but represent them in this really weird world. So that, you know, there, I knew there was like, well, we need to have, you know, we need to have like a foot chase or a car chase beat, but there's no cars and LA is in ruins. So how does that look?
Yeah.
And, you know, I know we need to see Bingo doing the shoe leather, and maybe it could be around the docks, but where would the docks be if this is like post-apocalyptic? Is it still like the harbor of Los Angeles or Long Beach, or is it more inland, like some, you know, part of the state has broken off in an earthquake, let's say. Yeah. So like, and then, you know, now Beverly Hills and Bel Air, which are like the ritziest places in LA, now they've become the seedy seaside town. And what does that look like? So it was just like really trying to take all those beats from, you know, what we think of as like classic detective fiction and present them in a fresh way that we could only do in the world of detective.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just think you did like a really great job with kind of creating this world, creating the characters, and sort of like, as the character goes through, they discover that obviously what it happens in a lot of stories, that everything that they were told is a lie and,
yeah,
and is broken, but you never sort of like, I never got pulled out by that. Like, you know what I mean? Like sometimes there's stories where it's like, oh, you know, character discovers something and it's still, it's not within the realm of the world that they exist in. And I think you did like a really great job of like going through and being like, oh my gosh, like it's all falling apart, but never stepping outside of what you already created. And I just have to give you kudos for that, because that's part of what I really enjoyed. The journey of the character, the discovery, and then once the discovery happens, I never felt like, yeah, this is BS. Like, no, this all works really well. So congratulations on that.
Well, thanks, man. It's always the BS detector is the ultimate. All these things. No, seriously, because like, you know, it's when you're doing creator-owned books, like, you know, we get to do it, Maverick. It's like, is this going to make sense to anyone but me? Is anyone but me going to care about this? You know, like, is anyone else going to be able to kind of connect these dots in their head the way I think I'm doing right now? So again, that's like where your team becomes really instrumental, and you know, getting Marco's feedback, getting Christine and Mike's feedback, and you know, also Dave Sharp, our letterer, I think was really instrumental in kind of helping to find the you know, the identity of the book and the identity of the world of detective, and just making sure that, you know, it could be crazy, but it had to be consistent at the same time. And I'm happy to hear that we hit the mark for you.
Definitely. Definitely. Let's move on to Scoop. I mean, I could talk about detective all hour long if that's what you want to talk about, but I really enjoyed Scoop as well. Like it's kind of rare that I'm given several books to read by the same creator, some, and both of them kind of like knock it out of the park for me, like on equal notes, but for different things. What is Scoop about? Let's let people know about that book, because I really enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, well, Scoop is the elevator pitch is it's Veronica Mars meets X-Files.
And got it.
So it's set in my hometown of Miami, which is also Mad Cave's hometown, coincidence. Uh-huh. And it's about Sophie Cooper, who is, you know, sort of like your typical 15-year-old Cuban-American girl growing up in Miami. I'm also Cuban-American on my mom's side, clearly, given my ridiculous name that we already talked about earlier.
Yeah, well, my mom's Colombian, so join the club. There you go. Okay. Yep. Yep.
So, you know, like a normal teenager, Sophie just kind of like wants to keep her head down and get through life. But her dad is accused of kind of this major financial crime. And there hasn't been a trial yet, but you know, all the news trucks and news cameras are parked outside their home 24/7. He's on house arrest with an ankle monitor in the works. And the whole world, even though there hasn't been a trial, the whole world believes that her dad is guilty of sin. The only person who believes he's innocent is Sophie. Mm-hmm. And in her kind of teenage 15-year-old mind, she thinks, well, if the news is villainizing my dad, then I'm going to use the news to clear his name. And so she gets an internship at a local news station, only they are the worst news station in Miami, if not the planet.
Yeah.
They,
yeah.
All the facts wrong. They show up late for reports. Their news chopper's been repossessed. They like can't afford the Doppler weather system. So the meteorologist has to hold little cardboard suns and clouds in front of a map. It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
it's
she's totally like, where's my Velcro? I can't stick the clouds under. Yeah, it's really good.
But you know, Sophie's like just so single-minded in pursuit of clearing her dad's name. And along the way, she kind of catches the notice of the senior reporter at the station, a guy named Hal Ritz, who's sort of, you know, washed up and kind of just sort of coasting through life, but is actually a really talented and ethical journalist. And he sees something of himself in this young kid, Sophie, and he takes her under his wing and he lets her, you know, as an intern, there's not much you can do like in real life. You basically get coffee for people, you make copies, you answer phones. But he lets her go through what they call the broken cases, which are sort of like all these dead end tips or crank calls of news stories and, you know, stuff about like lights in the sky over the Everglades or ghosts or chupacabras, blah, blah, blah. Sophie doesn't care about any of that until she realizes that it's all actually true and it's all connected to the case against her dad. And so now she has to go out there and she has to report this thing and prove to everyone else that all these supernatural things really exist. Because if she can do that, then she can clear her dad's name and boom, she gets to be a normal teenager again. Yeah. So that is sort of the larger narrative of Scoop that plays out across each volume. But each book kind of has its own standalone mystery too. There's usually like a true crime mystery that's based off of something actually in the headlines. And then we also have like a sci-fi plot for Sophie too. And we try and get them to intersect in ways that are hopefully surprising to the reader and to Sophie. Yeah. In volume one, there's a story about a fashion designer in Miami who's murdered. And that's based on when I was living in Miami, I got to intern at CNN. And my first day on the job was the day that Gianni Versace got murdered outside.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was crazy. And they sent me down in the news van on like within an hour of being there. I got to ride down the news van to the scene of the crime. It was really pretty horrific. But, you know, selfishly, it was an incredible education into like how the news is made and what goes on, not just in front of the camera, but behind the scenes, too. And so that really was like kind of planted the seed for Scoop way back when. So we kind of take that as a starting point, and it almost seems kind of like a straightforward, you know, crime, you know, true crime story. But then it very quickly takes this left turn into the paranormal, and that's what like really sets Sophie along her journey. So that's Scoop in a very long-winded nutshell.
Yeah, I kind of wish that you hadn't revealed the whole, you know, metaphysical, you know, whatever X-Files part of it. Cause I went into this blank, like I didn't really know what either one was about. And I kind of like that. Like I when I was young, like maybe like 18 or 19, I saw the film La Femme Nikita for the first time in New York City. I was waiting for a friend and I had several hours to kill. And I just happened to be like outside of the Angelica movie theater. I was like, why don't I just go see like a movie, and La Femme, I'll go see that. Like, I don't even know what it is. Like, I don't even know why I did it. And it just blew my mind. And like reading Scoop, like I had no idea what I was going into. And like reading Scoop, I was reading it and I was like, okay, cool. Like Nancy Drew, like, yeah, teenage stuff. And I'm like, this is very charming. I like it. And then like, you get to like almost halfway through the book and it's like, wait a minute. What is going on here? And you did a very good job. I wish people did not know that part of it going in, because for me, I was like, you know, there's a bit in the early part of the book where like somebody disappears like on a highway. And I was like, oh, wait, what is, maybe there's something. And then as it went, it's like my brain went into denial or something. But then later on, you get into the book and I was like, I don't want to spoil what it is, but somebody gets helped by a creature in a swamp. And I was like, what is going on? Like, it was really great and it surprised me. So, you know, I almost feel bad that people are going to go into this, if they listen to this interview, kind of knowing that aspect of it, because I was just like, oh, great. Like, I sat up and I was like, it's good, but it just got better. You know,
well, that's so interesting to hear you say that. And you have my complete permission to go back and bleep over everything I said about it.
No, I won't do that, but it's great. But
no, it's, you know, so I'm like you. I love to be surprised by a story.
Yeah.
And I remember watching From Dusk Till Dawn for the first time in the theater and not knowing much about that. I thought it was just going to be another kind of Tarantino movie, or I think Robert Rodriguez directed it, so there's gonna be a little bit like, you know, Mariachi or Pulp Fiction kind of thing. And then, you know, spoilers for a 30-year-old movie, like basically the midpoint of the movie is they realize that they're in this bar they're full of vampires, and all of a sudden it becomes like this incredibly gory monster.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you don't know anything about that movie and you watch it, it's like such a punch in the face when it happens. It's
you had no idea the vampires were coming?
No.
Wow. That must have been crazy.
It was crazy. And like, you know, I don't know, I must have seen a trailer or something, but for whatever reason, it didn't connect. And maybe it's just a testament to like George Clooney and Quentin Tarantino are pretty funny and engaging leading up to it. And
sure,
just,
sure.
Like, it's setting up to be this one kind of story about them trying to cross the border into Mexico to you know, because they're criminals and, you know, flee the law. And then it just takes this complete turn and becomes this other genre movie completely. And I loved that, you know, like I thought that was so neat. So for me with Scoop, I just figured like, well, that's the way it would be in real life. You know, if you're reporting stuff, it would be a surprise to you that aliens are real or ghosts are real. I mean, depending on what your belief system is, but yeah. For Sophie, she was, you know, pretty skeptical kid, kind of jaded by this point in her life because of, you know, her family sort of living under the glare of the 24-hour news cycle for like a year. So that kind of like caused anyone to sort of put their armor up. But then when she discovers the sci-fi stuff, it should feel like really out of the blue for her, because I think that's how it would feel for most of us if it were to happen in real life.
Yeah.
But strangely, other people are like, they wish that the sci-fi stuff was very clear from the beginning of the book. And they were actually, you know, not really. Yeah, but like, you know, there have been people who've been interested in like developing Scoop as like a TV show or whatever.
Sure.
And it's almost like a Rorschach test when you present the book to people, because some people love the idea of like Sophie as this, you know, very Veronica Mars or Nancy Drewish teen journalist investigator. Right?
Yeah.
And sci-fi stuff is cool too. And then there's other people who love the kind of giant sci-fi conspiracy aspect of it. And they're like, oh, and then, yeah, also the thing about the girl detective is neat also. So it's some people try and put one ahead of the other and—
Don't sell it to those people, because the great part of the book is like her, like she's great. Like you did a great job of like creating a charming and like believable central character, and to me it was very interesting. Hey, you did a great job with like setting up the internship, and you did a great job with telling the story of the dad, and I was like, oh, all this is very interesting, and the mom and how hard it must be for somebody accused of a crime, and like that all felt like very like, you know, for a YA book, like real, not even just a YA book, but like it felt grounded and stuff, like, and as I was reading it, like I was just like taken in, right? I was like, okay, I thought like this is kind of like, I keep using Nancy Drew, you keep using Veronica Mars, but I liked it, you know what I'm saying? And then once I got to the sci-fi stuff, I was like, oh, this is cool, but it's neat, but to me it was kind of secondary. So yeah. We've just met, you know, in this interview, but my advice to you would be like, do not sell to those people, because it is one of the aspects of this book that I found very charming and original and made me like it so much.
Well, no worries there. we're not doing it with them. And like, I always say, I mean, it's the same thing. Like it's about Sophie, you know, yeah. And there are certain things that are non-negotiable. Like it, you know, she has to be her, you know, it's got to be her character. You can't radically, or I don't want to radically alter her. You know, some people have even wanted to like age her up. So it's going to be like sexier. Or something.
Just
like,
kill me now. Kill me now. No.
I know. This is.
Bring
this
me
is
into the negotiation room with you. I'd be like, what is wrong with you? Stop it. Stop it.
This is why I prefer comics to Hollywood by a mile, because you don't sort of have to have those crass considerations usually.
Yeah.
But no, it's like, I've her character is non-negotiable. Her cultural background is non-negotiable. And I really feel like Miami setting is non-negotiable. I don't know that the story works anywhere. Like, you know, could we set it in Vancouver? And I'm like, well, I guess, but I wouldn't know how to tell that story. I'm not from there. And, you know, I know it's like a, you know, sort of hackneyed thing to say that the city's a character. But I think in Scoop, Miami legitimately is. Like, it's very much a love letter to my hometown. And I think so much of like the specificity of it and the groundedness of it has to do with that, the setting of that city and like what a melting pot it is. And we have, although it's mostly about Sophie, I think we really do have kind of a cool ensemble cast, and you get to spend even more time with them in the future volumes. And they're all like part of the fabric of Miami and South Florida anyway. So when people start to talk about, you know, beefing up the sci-fi stuff at the expense of character, I'm already pretty certain it's not going to work out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I would hope not, because I mean, that's again what was really what's great about Scoop and, you know, Tech Div is you do a really good job of like introducing and filling out the supporting cast as much as you need to, right? Like, particularly in the very beginning, like the helicopter pilot, like I was like, this guy's great. Like, I was just like, this character's great. And then, like you said, the newscaster who's kind of like washed up and, you know, loves to drop names, you know, and be like, my pal Walter Cronkite or whatever. Like that was just like, that's great. Like, I was just like, I very much enjoyed this. And she is very fleshed out and has a very, I loved her brother who's like, you know, like the gadgeteer and like he's interested in like tech and stuff. So he helps her with like little devices, which is great. And yeah, I mean, so to me, it's like taking that stuff out. No, there's so much ridiculous sci-fi mystery wannabe X-Files, you know, stuff out there. And what makes the X-Files work is Scully and Mulder. Like, yes, all the mystery stuff, but their dynamic and how weird Mulder is and how grounded she is. Like, they have personalities, and that's why you fell in love with the show, right?
Totally. And that's the point I try to make all these people is like, you could have the biggest effects budget in the world and you could make, you know, the most compelling sci-fi effects ever. But if you don't care about the characters, then it's all meaningless.
Yeah.
And to what you were saying earlier about things being grounded, I mean, that was something else I think learned on the How to Train a Dragon stuff is like, yeah, it's this whimsical world of dragons and, you know, sort of an alternate history. But the character, like the life on the island of Burke and the way the human characters interact with each other, that was all very realistic, you know? And I think whenever you're doing a story that's like, you know, sci-fi or horror or anything supernatural, to the extent that you can make all the real world stuff as realistic as possible, I have found that the audience is way more willing to go on the journey with you and suspend their disbelief and go into the kind of the crazier parts. So that was like very much the case with Detective, trying to make Bingo real, trying to make her civilization as realistic as possible in those relationships, so that when you start to encounter like the talking coyotes and stuff, it's not like totally taking you out of the story.
Yeah.
And for Scoop, it's the same thing. Like, really wanted to make sure that Sophie and her family were real, because, you know, I think it's good in terms of like when we start to get into the you know, weirder, wilder stuff, it, you know, we care about these people, there's stakes to it. And also, like, I think a lot of it was just sort of based on my own life. Like, Scoop is strangely autobiographical because of the internship thing and the hometown thing. You know, my dad was never on house arrest for a crime he didn't commit or anything. That part's a little bit of invention, but her little brother Kit is based on my younger brother, who's a real kind of like science prodigy and would always be making weird inventions in our home and kind of disassembling old Discmans and turning them into things. And, you know, and a lot of the characters that you referenced from the news station, they're loosely based or composites of like some of the personalities I got to actually meet when I was at CNN. There was a reporter there, their senior reporter was a guy named Bob Vito, and his real name was Roberto Viverito, but Bob Vito looked, you know, read better on the TV screen.
Sure, sure.
So Hal Ritz, the reporter in Scoop, is very much based on him. And he, this guy, Bob Vito, was a really nice guy. He took me under his wing and for, you know, one summer and kind of gave me a sort of a different perspective on the news world. So, I'm also like a big sort of comedy nerd. And there's a guy named Del Close who you know, taught comedy out of Chicago for years and you know, taught Bill Murray, Bob Odenkirk, Mike Myers, I mean, so many people. And he had this rule, which was don't invent, remember. Meaning like, instead of like, you know, when you come to sort of like a fork in the road in a story, don't just make up something, try and remember something for your life and at least use that as inspiration. Mm. So that's what I always try to do with Scoop, which is like, all right, well, we need this kind of character here. And, you know, how do I not do like the obvious or generic choice? How do I take like something I know and then maybe put a little bit of a spin on it? And the same absolutely goes for Tective. And I think maybe what you were responding to when you were reading it, and it felt like, if I'm paraphrasing you correctly, like a crazy world, but one that was also sort of like authentic and credible.
Yeah.
It's that we didn't, like I was saying, there's no throwaway characters. Like everyone that she met, it's like, well, I could just say it's a mutant in the script and Marco could draw whatever he wanted and it would look beautiful. But like, what, hold on a minute, let's see, like, could this be like a real person? What's their story or whatever? And you know, like, you don't have to write a whole Bible about each one, but I think just taking that time to think about each one and make it as specific as possible, it really helps with the world building and it really helps with the stakes and the setting and just making everything feel real. And that's really what I'm going for, even though these are all like, you know, genre stories. I want real emotion in the characters and I want our readers to feel something too.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to let this hour expire without mentioning the artist on Scoop, cause I really like them a lot. Joseph Cooper has a real Carl Kessel kind of like appearance to the art. I really, really enjoyed this artwork too. And it's so different from Tective, but they're both artists are really effective at, you know, making their world like, you know, shine or spark, you know what I'm saying? And like Joseph, to me, you know, it's set in the real world and does like a really great job of like grounding it and establishing it as like a real place that you and I would walk through.
So yeah, Joe did a great job and thank you for mentioning him. Also,
I really liked his work. Yeah.
Colorist Simon Robbins, you know, really put a beautiful extra spin on all that.
Absolutely.
And our letter, Dave Lamphere's also incredible and a legend in the industry and in my book anyway. And Christina and Mike edited these as well. Starting with volume two, we have a different artist, Pablo Andres, who is also fantastic. And he's illustrated volume two, which is out now. And he's illustrating volumes three and four also. And his stuff is incredible. And I think it takes, I hate books when like the art style changes completely and is very jarring. I think there's a really nice transition between the work Joe did on volume one and what Pablo starts to do in volume three, or, I'm sorry, in volume two. And then in volume three, like I can't wait to talk about that book. Hopefully you can have me come back on.
Yeah, whenever you want.
I'm really proud of it. And Christina just sent it off to the printers, but Pablo and Simon and Dave all really got to start working together like on page one, panel one. And it really shows like their styles have really gelled and meshed. It looks great together in volume two and also in volume one with Joe's work. But something about volume three, it just like kind of clicked into a whole other gear. So I hope people check out volume one, and I hope they really like it enough to check out the next volumes. I think it gets better and better, but again, I'm kind of biased.
That's great. That's great. I wanted to ask you one more question because it sounds like we are kind of in the same boat. Like, you are half Cuban, I'm half Colombian. And one of the things that I really liked about Scoop is that you don't see Latino or Latinx people kind of like with the complexion that I, you know, that isn't necessarily the stereotype, like sort of like darker skin, darker hair and stuff like that. And it's one of the things that I wouldn't say, I mean, I can pass, like, you know what I mean? I look like a European, you know, because of my father's side and possibly a bit from my Latin heritage as well, because if you know anything about, you know, there's light skin, light eyes, people in South America, Central America, you know, it's just a stereotype. So I just wanted to ask you about that because I was reading it and I was like, okay, she's half Latina or Latinx or, you know, whatever phraseology you want to use that doesn't offend you at this point, get over it, people, whatever. But, I was very much like, because I mean, I have had people be like, you're not Latin. And I'm like, no, I'm very Latin. Like, my mother is Colombian and we speak Spanish. And then I've had Latin people like talk about me in Spanish. And then I break out in Spanish and they're like, holy shit. And then I'm like their best friend and stuff like that. So just from sort of like your experience, like, was it important to have that in this book? Like, what are the thoughts about the visual aspects of a Latina character, or that's part Latin?
Well, thank you for asking this, because it's something I've thought about my entire life. And
I think you and I might be in the same boat. Yeah.
I totally pass as a white guy.
Yeah.
I'm bilingual, and you know, it was interesting. I think probably most teenagers feel this way, but I just speak to my experience. You know, when I was growing up, and I was that age, I never felt like I really belonged in either world.
Oh,
you know,
God, you and I are in the same boat. I've talked about this on the podcast several times. Anyway, go on.
No. And like, I've since in my life met other people who come from like, you know, mixed racial or cultural backgrounds, and they have the same experience, which is like, you kind of almost feel like an interloper in either thing.
Yeah.
So sometimes, and actually that was, I think, a really critical component of Sophie's character, which is like, she's someone who just feels kind of, even though her family's under the glare of the news cameras, she feels kind of like totally disassociated from the world. Everyone in her hometown thinks her dad's guilty, so she's like a pariah at school, except for one boy, Milo, who kind of is the school AV club geek and sort of makes up one part of our cute little love triangle. And, so she doesn't fit in there. She doesn't have any friends. She, you know, her family's kind of excommunicated. She's an intern where she's kind of the low man on the totem pole at the station, and everyone there's so busy putting out fires of their own making, they don't really have time for her, except for Hal. So kind of like that thing of like, you belong to two communities and yet you still feel incredibly lonely.
Yeah.
Was a good fit for just Sophie's character as she's going through this period in her life, right?
Yeah.
And I also like, you know, there were times where, I could turn on the Spanish and then people realized I heard everything they were and understood everything they were saying about me.
Yeah. You
know, not behind my back, but to my face, but they just thought I couldn't understand it. And I think that's kind of a cool tool for Sophie to have as like a detective, is being like bilingual and, you know, being able to communicate with these two different communities. So even though she doesn't feel like she's necessarily part of either one or any community, she's able to interface with each of them, and she's able to find out things just from being like a young person who can speak a couple of languages that, you know, more experienced reporters might not even think to, you know, pursue the story that way.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like giving her like a little bit of a superpower too. Like in Miami, it's there's a huge Cuban community, of course, and I'm part of it, but you've got people from South America, a lot of people from Colombia, a lot of people from Europe. It's like a really international city with a lot of business. So, you know, like there's all these influences there. And I didn't really appreciate it when I was a kid growing up there, but now I look back on it and think I was so fortunate to grow up in that kind of melting pot and to see that kind of diversity. And so we've had there are ongoing conversations about like nailing the different skin tones for the characters. Like Sophie's dad is a white guy. her mom is Cuban. She's slightly darker complected, brunette, and, you know, based a lot on my mom. You know, maybe not my mom's, I think, not as difficult as Sophie's mom is in the book. You know, then also,
make sure your mom knows that before. I mean, yeah, she's read the book. I'm sure you had to tell her this isn't based on you, mom. Yeah.
I made the mistake of also naming the mom Dulce, which is the name of my mom's when she was growing up. So yeah. I sort of still catch hell for that, but it was not like I wasn't thinking of it in those terms. But, you know, there's another character, Usnavi, who's the other part of sort of the love triangle for Sophie. And he's fully Cuban, first generation American, I guess you'd say. And he's an intern at the Miami-Dade Police Department's crime lab. And so, you know, we just wanted to make sure there was kind of like a nice range of skin tones for all these different characters. But, you know, we have in volume two, we start to explore the Haitian community in Miami. That's a really big part of the patchwork there. The sheriff character is part of the Miccosukee tribe, you know, sort of out by the Everglades. And, trying to like really show the kind of the full spectrum of the cultures and backgrounds and all these things that make Miami wonderful, in my opinion. And the last thing I'll say about that is, like, when I was growing up, there weren't too many cool Hispanic characters in comics.
Yes, yeah.
There was a vibe in the Detroit era Justice League, and Jerry Conway was really trying, and I don't begrudge him this, but, you know, Vibe would end every sentence with like essay or amigo.
I can't. Don't even get me started. They would say like "ay caramba" or like.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's just.
Oh, Martian Manhunter. So yeah, it's that kind of thing. So I was like, well, if in my, because of, you know, sort of the privilege of my mixed backgrounds, if I can maybe move us forward a little bit on that front, I'm going to do everything I can.
Absolutely.
And so I appreciate you picking up on that and identifying with it. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the thing that I want Latino, Latina representation. I want, but there are some of us that don't look like, you know, whether we're of mixed blood or even directly from South America. So, you know, that's one of the things my mother used to be like, there's Colombian women who are blonde and blue-eyed. And I used to be like, you're crazy, crazy lady. Like, and then I met somebody in college who was from Colombia and looked like they were like freaking from Sweden or something. And I was just like, oh, wow. Like obviously, you know, whether that's European people coming to some, you know, their descendancy or whatever. But I just, for me, when I read this, I was like, wait, hold on, you know, and obviously I want darker people's skin to be represented as they should, but I don't see this type of Latin person in a book, and maybe rightfully so, maybe not. I don't know. But you understand where I'm coming from? I just saw it and I was like, oh, cool. Like, I get that. Like, you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. And I think for a lot of us, like when we think about another culture, especially one that we don't belong to, we just sort of assumed it's like a monolith, like everyone looked the same. But, you know, like, and so, you know, not to get political, but people were talking in this most recent election about the Latin vote, and everyone's talking about it like every Latin American person comes from the same country or has the same values or the same experience, and that's not true. Yeah. You know, people who are of Cuban heritage have different, you know, values and customs and practices than some people in Mexico or Colombia or wherever. Like, there are all these rich histories and nuances to every single culture, and it's a mistake to try and like paint them with all the same Pantone skin color in a comic book or in a TV show or whatever. So I felt like we had an opportunity and a responsibility, honestly, in something like Scoop, to like show that even within the you know, Latin community in the city of Miami, there's a tremendous amount of variety, and it's the same in New York City or anywhere else you go on this planet.
Nice. Well, Richard Ashley Hamilton, just like Christian Horn, the least Latin name you could have, but I get it. Like, I totally am with you. Thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. I really enjoyed chatting with you. I really enjoyed reading your work. I'm going to keep an eye out for Scoop and Tech Div. I think that these are both really great books. I mean, Mad Cave, they're always doing excellent work. And I mean, I'm continually impressed with them, and I'm impressed with you. So thank you for your time.
Oh, it was truly my pleasure. Thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to talk about these books. And I hope we can do it again real soon. This was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And where can people find you online? Do you have a website? Are you on the socials? Like, where can people find you?
I am very infrequently on X at Regards Richard. And then I'm on Instagram and Facebook under my full name at Richard Ashley Hamilton. But I think if you just, you know, Google me, you can find me. I'm not so great on social media, but I love talking to people. So if anyone, you know, reaches out in a nice way, I'm always happy to engage with them. And I really love meeting people at conventions and stuff. And I don't know when this episode is going to drop, but I will be going back to my hometown for the Miami Book Fair at the end of November. I think it is the 22nd through the 24th.
Oh, nice.
So if your listeners happen to be around there and want to come by, Mad Cave is going to have a booth there. They always do a great job at shows. And you can check out Scoop and check out all the other incredible books that Mad Cave puts out.
That's great. Well, congratulations on, you know, getting these books out and working with Mad Cave and just doing an all-around great job. I mean, like I said, I very much enjoyed both of them, and I'm very happy to read them, and I've become a fan. So, you know, congrats. And as far as the social media, you haven't jumped on Blue Sky yet? That's where everyone's going. Blue Sky.
I see the comics Twitter is very quickly migrating over there. I guess I'll check it out. I just don't like social media in general.
Me neither.
And we can get on another conversation, but that starts to become a big thing in Scoop is like, you know, what does social media mean for news and reporting, and, you know, what's facts and what's fake news? And anyway, whole other conversation. But I will check it out.
Absolutely. Well, it's a mess, people, but I kind of liked Blue Sky. But any final thoughts, sir?
No, just that I appreciate you saying all those kind words about the books. It's very meaningful to me. And I hope your listeners take a chance on these books. I'm really proud of them. I believe in them. And you know, I think if anyone has read any other Mad Cave or Maverick books, you know, there's a pretty high benchmark of quality. They just don't print whatever. It's all really good stuff. And they have great teams, not just creative teams working, but, you know, the marketing and sales and publishing and all that. Everyone puts a lot of work into it. And so it always means a lot to us when somebody checks out one of our books. There's a lot of competition out there, a lot of great comics, but if somebody's willing to give ours a shot, I think they're going to like them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I really enjoyed both of them. Scoop, Tech Div. What's the release date for Tech Div again?
Tech Div is December 10th in bookstores, December 11th in comic shops. Scoop volumes 1 and 2 are out right now. You can get them anywhere. I always recommend getting them at your local comic shop. But if you're not by one, you can go to bookstore.org. You can always do Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but bookstore.org helps small business owners. Two more volumes are going to be coming out next year as well.
Yeah, Tech Div would make a great Christmas gift. So there you go. All right, right in time for the holidays. I loved both books. My name is Christian Horn. This has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check me out at parttimefanboy.com. I am on Facebook. I am on Instagram. I am on Threads. And I joined Blue Sky, which seems like, you know, like a very neat place, although I hate social media. So who knows? Who knows what'll develop? But in any case, please check out Scoop. Please check out Tech Div. Richard Ashley Hamilton, thank you so much for your time. Oh, and our email at Part-Time Fanboy is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy. Part-time. Part-time fanboy.com.